You know, Bev, I'm really tired. I could use a pick-me-up.
Have you heard of Spark Plug Coffee?
What is that?
Well, rejoice, Ryan, and fellow Canadians. No longer are you beholden to the selection offered by your grocery store or forced to make special trips to your local hipster Java joint. Spark Plug Coffee offers delivery all over Canada of freshly roasted, high-quality beans right to your door. Spark Plug custom roasts your beans to order so that it's always fresh and consistently delicious.
And how do I acquire this product?
Just go to their website, sparkplugcoffee.com, to get started.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Merry Christmas, podcast fans. Many thanks for checking out the Top 100 Project, the weekly look back at the 123 pictures on the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of most outstanding American movies. First, you should know we are going to spoil any surprises in this film. I am Ryan Ellis with the haughty Texas hottie, my blonde bride, Bev.
That's me.
And of course, people should know that hottie and hottie are two different words. Look them up if you didn't know that already. All right, the coming attractions trivia for this week's film, The Last Picture Show. Name at least three of the movies shown at the movie house.
Okay, the first one's easy, Father of the Bride. Mm-hmm. This shows that in the marquee. The last movie they show is Red River, which you made me guess, or gave me many opportunities to guess when we were watching the film. And the third one I had to look up, it's Wagon Master. And there's one more that I can't remember.
Well, I didn't see Wagon Master, then there's five. That's why I said at least three, I didn't know if I missed any.
I can't remember, what are the other two?
I saw four. You said Father of the Bride, you said Red River, the first and last that we noticed. The two in the middle that I saw, Sands of Iwo Jima, John Wayne film, and Winchester 73, a James Stewart movie.
Yeah, Winchester 73 I remember seeing in the marquee now.
And this movie house is repertory theater because the movie is set between November 1951 and October 1952. Father of the Bride, that would have been around that time. That makes sense. Sands of Iwo Jima is 49, Red River is 48, Winchester 73 is 50. So all those other three movies should have long since played out. And that fits the theme of this movie, that everything about this town is dying or gone or in the past. But we are getting ahead of ourselves here on the podcast. Let's do the particulars of the film first. The Top 100 Project's 81st motion picture, Last Picture Show, was not on AFI's 1998 Top 100, but was one of the 400 nominees, then crept onto the 2007 Top 100 in 95th place between Sam Jackson flicks Pulp Fiction and Do the Right Thing. Last Picture Show premiered in New York on October 3rd, 1971, just a few days before The French Connection's premiere, and that is our next film. Then Columbia Pictures released it on October 22nd. The movie didn't cost much to make, but it was a tidy hit. And Bev will describe that film for you with the skinny.
This is a year in the life of 1950s West Texas as high school kids struggle with love, lust, death, and growing up. Timothy Bottoms is Sonny and Jeff Bridges is Dwayne, lifelong friends who cross romantic swords over the beautiful but selfish JC played by Cybill Shepherd.
Or in a nutshell, hoes before bros. An expression I hate, but I'll use it in this one instance to make you laugh.
Well done.
All right, what did you think of The Last Picture Show?
It was so sweet and charming to watch that I think it conceals its depth. And I really enjoyed it, but I was on the fence about whether or not I agreed that it belongs on the list. But I haven't stopped thinking about it. And the more I think about it, the more I'm changing that initial opinion. It's a better movie than you think when you're watching it. Does that make sense?
Stays with you. Yeah, sure.
It really does.
Movies do. I don't know if that's true for me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's get into some other particulars that I like to cover, of course. The Rotten Tomatoes critics, we haven't said this very often, 100%.
Right?
47 fresh, zero rotten, obviously. Loved it, and 90% of audiences.
I think something you have to acknowledge with Rotten Tomato ratings, when a movie has been sold to everybody as the greatest movie ever, then people have such high expectations when they see it, they're bound to be disappointed.
Yeah.
Whereas when you have a film like this that's kind of a forgotten gem, everyone's just going to be pleasantly surprised. Somebody who goes back and watches it because they're reviewing a Blu-ray release or something like that is going to be so delightfully surprised that this movie is better than they expected. I think that generates more positive reviews.
But if you're a critic, you're probably more predisposed to like it.
That's true.
Because unless you want to be Pauline Kael and go against the grain, she'd love to do that, you're bound to feel that pressure of, you better like this movie. Okay, a few more numbers then. The box office, 1971. We're going to cover three movies from that year. This is the first of the three. The movie was seventh at the box office in 71. Billy Jack was number one.
Never even heard of it.
I saw it once. I don't remember it at all. It's a monster hit from that year, though. French Connection was number three, and Clockwork Orange was number nine. So the three movies we cover all in the top 10, including Billy Jack, which we do not cover by any means. My favorite is definitely Clockwork, and this is the least of the three for me, and I'm going to say this now. I like the movie. I respect the movie, absolutely, but it does not belong on the list. And one of the reasons why I've used this so often, influence and also other AFI lists. It is not represented on the other AFI list. And influence, I don't think it's very influential.
It doesn't really seem like it's breaking new ground, at least not in some revolutionary way. It's as though John Ford and Robert Altman made a movie together, but there isn't anything all that impressively new in it.
I like that. John Ford is the obvious and easy comparison because Bogdanovich had three idols that he had become friends with. He was an acolyte of. Ford is one. Another one is people probably know Orson Welles, who lived with Bogdanovich for a while around this same time in the 70s. Yeah. And then the other one was Hitchcock. Bogdanovich had been a film critic. Have we said his name yet? Peter Bogdanovich, the director of the film. I don't think we actually have. There you go. This is one and only FI film. He had done Targets before this, a really interesting pseudo-docu-horror type film he'd made. Boris Karloff was in that. In the 60s, Roger Corman, one of the many directors we're going to cover, who did Roger Corman films before they made it big. Scorsese, certainly another one, and so is Coppola. And then he had a string of films after this that were pretty big hits. What's Up, Doc, with Barbara Streisand. Paper Moon, with the O'Neills, Ryan and Tatum. And then a sequel to this film about 20 years later called Texasville. And then people probably know him as well as an actor from The Sopranos, as Melfi's psychiatrist.
Oh my God, I never put that
together. Psychiatrist.
Bogdanovich. Oh my God.
Yeah. And he also co-wrote the film with Larry McMurtry, the book's author. He edited the film. There's a bit of a story about that, that Don Cameron, who had edited Easy Rider, who was only sort of involved, and then he was maybe majorly involved in this film, but he wasn't involved. I don't really know the eventual story, but Bogdanovich says on the documentary, on the DVD, that he didn't want to take too much credit. This guy's got a huge ego, and I don't think it's ever been denied, but he was trying to slough some of that off, I guess.
But Cameron says that he may have done the rough cut, but Cameron is the one who polished and made plenty of creative contributions.
Interesting comparison, though. We talked about Bob Rafelson with Easy Rider because they ran BBS Productions, and that is the group of people. Harold and Bert Schneider and Bob Rafelson. BBS is the three of them. And they were the ones that made this movie as well, although it got released through Columbia Pictures. At one point in the production, somebody was questioning whether or not Bogdanovich was shooting enough film. How are we going to cut this together? Because, of course, people tend to overshoot movies, even now. Maybe more so now because of digital. They can do as many takes as they want to, and it doesn't cost that much in comparison. Rafelson saw the footage and realized what Bogdanovich was doing. He said, he's cutting this movie in his head. Leave me alone. Leave him alone. Because the movie's going to work out fine, and I guess it did.
And some directors work like that. Hitchcock worked like that. He edited the film in his head before he ever shot on set.
Yeah, George Tomasini was the editor in all of his AFI films. I think every single one of them, and many others, too. I think he edited something like 9 or 10 Hitchcock films. And he wasn't very often recognized for the editing Oscar, which whatever that means anyway. Maybe because people knew that old story about Hitchcock, he just cut the heads and the tails off the shot and just put the movie right into the film. And Bogdanovich, in this movie at least, is very similar. He is the author of this film, as much as anybody has been in a little while. We're into the auteur era now, where people will often write, direct, and produce. Coppola certainly is going to do that several times in the 1970s with AFI films. But let's talk about the themes. First, this is the rare teenager movie on the Top 100 Project.
Yeah, we haven't seen one of these in a while.
Well, The Graduate, arguably, because Benjamin and Elaine are both really late teenagers, and that is why I say arguably.
Well,
that
they're college graduates. They're becoming adults. I don't think it's quite the same as graduating from high school.
Right, so we want to include that one. That's even spurious. Clockwork Orange is going to have that theme in a way, because they're supposed to be younger than they really are. American Graffiti, clearly these guys are high school kids. We're going to cover that pretty soon, a couple weeks away. Rebel Without a Cause, we covered that earlier this year. Obviously, teenager movie.
Yeah, made over a decade before this one.
But here's one that has that generation. Now, we didn't say it in the skinny, but of course, the other generation has a big part of this movie, too. Ellen Burstyn and Ben Johnson and Cloris Leachman and many others also are in this movie. We're going to cover the cast soon. That's a major part of this podcast, just listing off all their credits. It's such a big cast. And much like American Graffiti, much like a movie that didn't make the AFI list, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, people went on to huge things after a movie that may have been successful in its own right. American Graffiti certainly was successful in its own right. But they wanted to big things out of this, probably building on what they got out of this movie. So I said themes, we said teenagers. The other big theme in this movie is sex. This movie is drenched in it. It's bathed in it. There's at least talk and thought about sex all the time, which is probably pretty realistic for people who are about this age. And the two main women in the movie, Sybil Shepherd as JC, her mother Ellen Burstyn as Lois, they are walking ads for sex. They are so gorgeous and beautiful, and you kind of want them. At least I did.
No, I see what you're saying. And sex is everywhere, but when it finally takes place, It's really very sexy. It's really passionless sex.
Yeah.
We see full frontal nudity, both female and male, which I was surprised for a movie from the 70s. We see that for the first time, but it's hardly erotic, and it's not even used to turn you on. It's more used to intimidate, to, like, illustrate how the peer pressure has gotten her in over her head.
Her being JC in the scene, yes, where she has to undress at the pool.
Mm-hmm. They're constantly pursuing sex, but they don't even really seem that interested when they're getting it. Sonny's bored in the car with his girlfriend who's, like, mechanically getting undressed, and Dwayne can't get it up when it's finally time to do it with JC. And then when he can get it up, she's not that impressed. Mm-hmm. Nobody even seems to like it, but it's gotta be, like, 50% of the scenes in this film are all about sex.
Even Sam Aline, the Ben Johnson character, who's only in the movie for about halfway, dies right around the 1 hour mark. And his character's big speech that probably won him the Oscar was about how he had this lost love. And you, of course, guessed not long after, during his funeral, about who the lost love was.
Oh, well, it was made pretty obvious.
And it was Lois Ellen Burstyn. But that's also about a sexual experience.
And she's cheated on her husband with Sam. She doesn't seem to hide the fact that she's exceptionally sad at his funeral. She also gives a finger to her lover, Abilene, right in front of her husband. Mm-hmm. And Abilene then sleeps with her daughter, and her daughter doesn't try to hide it. It's strange, the relationships they all have with sex. The Ruth and Sonny affair is an open secret, and her husband maybe doesn't seem to care. Bogdanovich, by the way, owned up to, in I think it was the commentary, what everybody guessed, which is that Ruth's husband, Billy, the coach, is a homosexual.
Yeah, at one point, Leachman has a piece of dialogue, "You just don't get it," to Sonny, because he comments about how the coach isn't doing something or other, and that's all that's really ever said. We see the two of them together, the Puppers, the coach, and Ruth, at the funeral for Sam Aline. I don't think we ever see them together again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you read between the lines, the coach is gay. But why does she latch on to Sonny in the first place?
That's a good question. He's a high school kid. He's half her age.
Their first sex scene, one of the only times we see people actually doing it in the movie. We see a lot of build-ups to it. We see the after effect of it. But this is the rare time we see the actual act happening. Sonny wipes the dirt off his feet. And then the bed makes that noise. She starts crying afterwards. It's the dream sex scene. Not at all.
Yeah.
But very real. And Sonny's done it before, or at least we think he may have done it before. She certainly has. She's a grown woman. But it's not erotic, and yet their relationship is probably the closest thing to love that any of the lovers have in this movie.
It's the most tender relationship we see between a man and a woman.
Even though he jilts her, and it's even the last thing we see in the movie is the two of them together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that last moment of tenderness, but also reconciliation between them.
She's settling yet again. She maybe settled for the coach way back when. She settled for Sonny as her lover, who didn't really want her when he had a chance to go with JC, who he only wanted because she's JC Farrow. He didn't really want to be with her. He just wanted to bang her. We can't use bad words in this movie because they don't swear. Like you said, there's full frontal nudity on the women and the dudes, and there's violence and all kinds of stuff, but there's no swearing, interestingly. But it's a sad ending. It's certainly the scene that won Cloris Leachman the Best Supporting Actress Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
She has pretty much a monologue. He doesn't really say very much. He knows he's got to go hat in hand to her.
Yeah, but he needs her. He needs something. He needs somebody to show some sweetness to him because he's been through so much and everybody's gone.
Did you notice he has a George Bailey type moment at the end of that movie? Billy is dead in just a random accident, sweeping the street. We see him at the very beginning of the movie, he's sweeping the street. Nearly the end of the movie, he's sweeping the street again, run over by guys who don't even really seem to care. And that motivates him because the Sam the Lion thing earlier, Billy actually is a pretty important character. That's Sam Bottoms. Sam Bottoms is going to be an Apocalypse Now for us. He's Lance the Surfer.
Oh, really?
I didn't want to give that away until right now, in case you didn't recognize him. Yeah, he's Lance Johnson in that movie.
Oh.
He actually had a better career than his brother, who is Timothy Bottoms, the main character. Timothy Bottoms.
He's wonderful in this movie, too. Timothy Bottoms is.
Yeah, Timothy Bottoms is effectively the lead of the movie. We definitely called an ensemble leading into it with our preview last week about how this would be our podcast this week. But Bottoms is the main character. He's in most of the scenes. Certainly, he's in more scenes than anyone else. He's been in business 43 years. He's still working. He was in The Paper Chase a few years later after this. He was in the sequel Texasville, as was Bridges, as was Sybil Shepherd. And as for Sam Bottoms, who plays Billy, this is his first movie. He's also in The Outlaw Josie Wales, a favorite of my friend Frank and I, and Seabiscuit. So his career is probably more impressive than his brother's is. Beginning of the movie, he's sweeping the streets. The middle of the movie, not maybe not quite the middle, actually, but around the third of the way in, he's manipulated in the sexual experience he doesn't want to have. Then Dwayne, great moment. And they cast Jeff Bridges. And one of the reasons why he was cast, because Jeff Bridges is a nice guy, can play nice, but he's a bit of a dick.
In the book, his character was far less likable.
Right.
And they wanted to soften him a little.
And he's hiding so that Sam won't see him. Everyone else, including Sonny, gets banned from the pool hall, the restaurant, and the movie theater. The picture show.
For hiring a prostitute to sleep with Billy. And Billy, I don't know if we've mentioned it yet, is intellectually disabled.
Yeah, he's retarded.
Yeah.
And he is a plot device, really. He's not really much of a character other than that.
But he represents innocence. Like, this is a movie with no children. You know, we're talking about it now. We said one of the major themes was sex. But to me, the major theme of the movie is death. You have the dying of a town. Businesses are failing. You barely see any customers anywhere. The film opens and closes with that street. It looks like a ghost town. There's a wind blowing through, practically blowing tumbleweeds through.
You do see tumbleweeds.
Oh, you do actually see tumbleweeds?
I think it's right before Billy gets run over.
Billy dies. Sam dies. They're the heart of that town. Mm-hmm. After that's happened and his friends have left, what does Sonny have there? He has nothing. And there's no children in this movie. Even though there's all this sex, there isn't a single pregnancy over the course of this year. You don't see any babies, no little kids even. That's a lot. There's no hope for this town. It truly is coming to an end. The last film we already mentioned, the actual last picture show, is Red River. They show a clip from that movie where at the end the cowboys are driving their cattle, and I guess this is supposed to be triumphant. You've seen the movie, so you
That's the beginning of Red River.
Oh, that's the beginning of Red River, because they're all like happily driving these cattle. They're so thrilled about it. And it's this happy scene, and then just minutes later, the truck that kills Billy is a truck that's transporting cattle, because that's how it's done now. There's no cowboys in the range lassoing doggies and doing it the old-fashioned way, the happy way. No, it's these men standing over Billy's dead body, really clinically discussing what happened. What was he even doing there? Mm-hmm. It's almost over the top how cold they are about just having killed a young man. But significant that we see the new cattle rustlers, right?
Yeah.
Driving a truck.
Through what might be a ghost town in the very near future.
Yeah. I read somewhere that the town is based on, had a population of roughly 1,000.
Well, Larry McMurtry, who wrote the novel, the 1966 book that was adapted by himself and Bogdanovich, they call it Anarene in the movie, and that mirrors Abilene in Red River. That was delivered by Bogdanovich. But they shot mostly on location in Archer City and a little bit around in that area, so mostly Texas. And that's what McMurtry based it on, was this kind of ghost town type atmosphere.
You mentioned that Bogdanovich and McMurtry wrote the screenplay together, but it's been suggested by both of them that Bogdanovich's wife at the time, Polly Platt, went through the book and wrote the first draft of the script.
Polly Platt was a huge part of this movie. She was a huge part of his life before this, and I don't know how much longer after this, because he started sleeping with, very openly, and it pissed off a lot of people in Hollywood, in fact, Sybil Shepherd.
Yeah.
He saw her face on a magazine cover. And when you see this movie, you can see why he physically, at least, would fall in love with her. Although, when I read about Polly Platt, she was his soulmate and she was his equal. Those two were a great combination. She was a big part of this movie. I don't think he would deny that in retrospect, even though he hasn't been with her for a long time now, obviously. But he started sleeping with Shepherd. This is her debut film. She never acted before. She's going to be in Taxi Driver. I think most people know that. She's in the sequel Texasville. Most people are going to know from Moonlighting with Bruce Willis on TV. And to me, she should have been a top 50 villain, or at least a nominee for the top 50 villain. She's certainly worse than Man from Bambi, which is on the villains list. She is a man killer, and she doesn't care about any of it. We talked about how she sleeps with just about everybody. I'm not saying that Sybil Shepherd was JC incarnate, but she did sleep with somebody, whether she meant to or not, and took him away from somebody else.
Yeah, her character, the character of JC, she doesn't even like sex, it seems. Mm-hmm. Yet she is, even as a teenager, so adept at manipulating men with sex. There's a scene where she wants to go to a party with a boy other than her boyfriend, Dwayne. So she fools around with Dwayne, gives him the idea that it's going to go further than usual tonight, and then stops it and leaves him right there just to get her way. It's so mean.
She uses Randy Quaid, also in his motion picture debut, to get to that party in the first place.
Yep.
Good old Randy Quaid. Who doesn't know that guy? What a career he's had. He was in The Last Detail a few years after this, a movie I just recently watched on YouTube. Great film with Nicholson. Brokeback Mountain. And many other things.
And we'll probably watch it soon because it's Christmas time. He's Cousin Eddie in Christmas Vacation.
Of course, maybe that's the most famous character he's ever played.
Yeah, I bet that's probably what most people would know him as.
But she uses him in this movie, too, to get that party in the first place. He doesn't get anything out of it whatsoever. At least Dwayne and eventually Sonny, who marries her. I don't know how that counts exactly legally, because they never actually consummate.
I think it gets annulled, or it's at least suggested that it does. And it's also suggested that she never had any intention of keeping the vows that she made with him.
It's almost like she marries him just to say to Ruth Popper, to say to the world, I can get this guy away from you. I'm hotter than you, Ruth.
Yeah, and to get attention. She's so thrilled when the cops find them, and she just wants to be the talk of the town. She just needs, like, one big last hurrah before she goes off to college so that everybody remembers her.
And Dwayne's already gone.
She's such a bad person.
Yeah, she's horrible. We've been talking about good-looking people. Jeff Bridges is pretty charming in this movie. His ducktail hairstyle and everything. He was very young and very new in the scene. Sybil Shepherd, just gorgeous. But like MASH, Dog Day Afternoon, we covered that in the Not One Hitter Project a few months ago, many of the cast members were first-timers, not the best-looking, and unconventional choices, like Quaid. I don't think Timothy Bottoms is the obvious choice to be a leading man in anything, and he didn't really become a leading man, like I said.
I think Timothy Bottoms is cute. He has those hangdog eyes. He's very likable. He's better looking than Jeff Bridges in this movie.
Okay, but Randy Quaid certainly isn't.
Oh, Randy Quaid certainly isn't. Cloris Leachman is great casting. She's not an unattractive woman by any means, but it's good that they didn't cast someone beautiful and sexy to play this lonely housewife.
Right. And Ben Johnson is not a bad-looking older fella. He's in 3 FI movies, actually. We've covered them all now. Yeah. We did Shane a long time ago for us. He did The Wild Bunch not that long ago. Cloris Leachman was in Butch Cassidy very briefly.
Mm-hmm.
People might know her from Young Frankenstein as Frau Blücher, who makes the horse whinny every time they say her name.
People will probably recognize her more from TV. She was one of the main cast in Raising Hope sitcom that played for 4 years with Martha Plimpton, and she's on Franklin and Bash now. She's done a bunch of other things.
Younger people have never heard of those shows before. I don't know anything about
maybe
them.
Maybe not.
Mary Tyler Moore is in maybe a more famous show that she was on.
Ah, she's a very funny lady. Not funny in this movie, but funny in lots of other
things. She's got to play the tragic, overlooked housewife. We said Ben Johnson, John Wayne's sidekick, very famously known for that. And that's what John Ford used as motivation to get him to take this role.
Yeah.
He didn't want to. He didn't like all the dialogue. Not that he has that much dialogue. Although, trivia question, I'm giving it away by saying this. Who's the first person to speak in this movie?
Is it Ben Johnson?
It would be Ben Johnson. But he didn't like dialogue in the first place. Doesn't have a lot of it in Shane. What he does have is pretty effective. Doesn't have a ton of it in Wild Bunch by any means. But Ford convinced him by saying, do you want to be Duke's sidekick for the rest of your life?
Yeah.
Jimmy Stewart could have this role, but Ben Johnson got it instead. And there's a very clear example of post-sync sound in this movie. We haven't seen a ton of it that I've really picked up on. I really did this time. His big scene where he has that speech with the Bottomses out by the lake when they're fishing. Sonny, of course, is listening intently. There's a strong wind, extremely windy scene, and yet it's a very quiet moment.
So the ADR'd the whole thing.
Yeah, and they often do in movies, but this is one time I actually picked up on it and made a note of it. Johnson won the Supporting Actor Oscar. Jeff Bridges was nominated for it against him. Who doesn't know Jeff Bridges by this point, but the only AFI film. When the first list came out, he was one of those actors I thought about after all the years that went by. I studied the AFI list, knew it very well, and thought, how does one of my favorite actors not make it somehow? But then he's not been in a lot of great films, a lot of good ones. Another Spencer Tracy, Mike Nichols type guy. I've talked about that a lot the last few months. Who didn't make a lot of great films, but a lot of films I've enjoyed a ton. Starman, Big Lebowski, of course.
Big Lebowski.
The Contender, which is a very underrated film. Crazy Heart won him the Oscar a few years ago. And you can go on his list forever.
The new Tron movie, hello.
And the original Tron.
Was he the original Tron?
Yeah,
too?
He's the main character.
Oh, that's why
Tron.
They cast him.
Yes, of course. I guess that was lost on you, wasn't it?
It came out when I was 2, plus I'm a lady. I wonder if someday The Big Lebowski will make the list. The Big Lebowski's on our list of comedies, isn't it?
I've gone through every single AFI nomination list. Every one of them.
He does it for you, people.
I do it for you and for myself because I'm insane about this.
Yes,
the only nomination the Big Lebowski got in any category.
That's right. That's right. We were
ready.
Just talking about this.
Get comfortable. The top 100 genres in the mystery category, but not the comedies. There are 500 comedy nominations and not the Big Lebowski.
That is the definition of absurdity. I don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah. All right, let's get back to the
last picture
show now. So Bridges, we talked about he's a likable actor playing a lousy guy. And in the sequel, Texasville, he becomes a rich oil failure. Spoiler alert on Texasville, which no one's ever going to watch, if they ever even watched this movie in the first place. And he becomes a roughneck in this movie, too. Mm-hmm. But he's also one of the football players. There's another theme in this movie, in the beginning more so, that funny running joke about how the football team is getting ranged on by everybody in town, about how they're not good enough, they can't catch, they can't run. And that's a theme that's been in many movies for sure. Not a ton of AFI movies, but a small town obsessed with high school sports. Hoosiers, Friday Night Lights, the TV show Friday Night Lights.
Mm-hmm.
And those two movies, Hoosiers and Friday Night Lights, when it comes to the actual sports part of it, on the basketball court or in the football stadium sports are two of the better ones. This movie doesn't show any of that stuff that we see in those movies, but it has the same kind of thing. Although, obviously, the Anarene team isn't very good to get to the point where those other teams do.
I think you're touching on something that we haven't talked about yet, which is how much the time and place plays such a big role in this film, and what a great job this film does of setting the time and place. You really feel like you're there. You really get the impression of what it would be like to be a teenager in West Texas in the 50s, and part of that is a town so obsessed with sports that old men cluck their tongues at you because you lost the big game.
Friday Night Lights is set in West Texas as well. That movie's also set in not quite the present of 2004 when the movie was made, but around that same time. Hoosiers is in the 50s, so about 30 years before the movie came out. And this is about 20 years before, almost actually to the same year, because it came out in 1971.
But that's just one of the many ways that they set the place. It's that, and it's the people walking around without explanation, dressed in their coveralls like they just came from the oil fields. Like you said, they're roughnecks. And the way that's just presented without comment and all kinds of great little touches.
This is the rarefied movie that's about people just working and having sex and hanging out.
Yeah, the plot meanders in and out. I mean, it has good structure. It definitely lagged a little in the middle. I think I said that when we were watching it, too. It lost steam in the second half, but the ending felt like a payoff.
One of the other things I want to touch on, you talked about setting the time and place. This movie captures that thing where these guys, whether they know it or not, are between meanings, if you will. Between wars, for one thing. War defines so many people in the 20th century. For America.
But they're not between wars.
That's what I was going to say. They're about 5 or 10 years too young to have fought in World War II. They're able to fight in Korea. He's just barely old enough. They're obviously quite a few years, many years before Vietnam will start. But Korea is also the forgotten war. We covered it in MASH, and that movie is supposed to be set in Korea, but Robert Altman tried best he could to make it be Vietnam. Korea is always the forgotten war. That's what they use for Manchurian Candidate as the basis for what happens to those characters, but it's such a small part of that movie.
Yeah. I feel like I've learned more about the Korean War by watching Mad Men than just about any movie I've ever seen. You're right. It's just rarely ever addressed.
So I don't mean to be sloughing off that war myself, but these guys are not really of the age to be in the wars that quote-unquote mattered. World War II or Vietnam. For glory or for failure.
Yeah, you're never reminded that there's war going on at all until Dwayne and Liz.
And when we mentioned about the movies, we mentioned Father of the Bride was the first one. That means, and the other movies mean, that we finally, in a small way at least, see Elizabeth Taylor again. We see Spencer Tracy again. We see John Wayne in Montgomery Clift, another AFI film.
That's true.
We thought we were done with those people, and yet they make their little cameo appearance in other films that may have been nominated for the list but didn't make it.
And speaking of Father of the Bride, or I should say speaking of fathers in general, we never get to know Sonny's parents. We meet his father so briefly, just briefly enough to know that there's something really strange going on with them and they're estranged in some way, but we never meet his mother. We never even see where he lives.
Well, Sam is really his father. Not literally, I'm not saying that, but Sam's his father figure.
Yes.
And that's why when Sam bans all the kids for what they did to Billy, he obviously feels most disappointed in Sonny, and when he forgives him later, Eileen Brennan is definitely the go-between with them. She's the one that runs the cafe and then Genevieve. Inherits the cafe when he dies. She's the one that bridges that gap. Sam wants to forgive Sonny. He wants to think, you're not a bad guy, and I wish I could forgive you. Oh, you gave me an excuse to forgive you because you actually do care about this kid. And then, yes, in the end, he is becoming the new Sam the Lion. That's why I bring up the George Bailey comparison, because I don't think he really wants to be part of this dusty one-horse town. Although, ironically, Bedford Falls is a relatively meaningful place, as we know from the end of that movie. It's over the top. But that town has something going for it. It may be a decent-sized, meaningful town in the years to come. This one doesn't, but he is fighting against that. And Billy was his brother figure. He wasn't his Harry Bailey, but he was something to cling on to. And I guess that's the thing. Sonny didn't have the family that George does. He didn't have the responsibilities that George does in the same positive way. His was kind of like, I'm running a pool hall. What's the point of that?
That is a great comparison because you do have a ton of similarities, except for the fact that Bedford Falls is a good town that has promise and a future, whereas Anarene is a failing town. It could be like the It's a Wonderful Life where he maybe shouldn't jump off a bridge, but should be dreaming bigger about his future the way George Bailey did, about traveling, about going somewhere, leaving like everybody else is. But he doesn't ever talk about leaving. He doesn't really talk about his future at all.
Yeah, they go to Mexico, he and Dwayne do, and that's when Sam dies, when they're gone. I don't think that Sam would ever, if he could see a ghost above, say, how did you leave? No one would know he was about to die now. What did he die of? Was it a stroke, a heart attack, or an aneurysm?
It was a stroke.
Ah, you're correct. Okay. We just mentioned Wonderful Life, a very famous Christmas movie. During the Christmas party, when we briefly meet Mr. Crawford, Sonny's father, The music during that party has a very John Ford feel, getting back to the comparison with Ford and Bogdanovich. There's music in that that's very My Darling Clementine-esque, mm-hmm. or Grapes of Wrath-esque.
Very Americana.
And then speaking of music, we usually cover this later on, but the composer in this film doesn't exist. The movie is another example. We've done so many of them lately, but there is no composer because he's using diegetic sound. It's coming from jukeboxes and radios, and in this case, a live band. And often playing old classics and old standards. In Dwayne and JC's first try at sex where he can't get it up, the song is Wish You Were Here. She wishes that the boy she wants to sleep with was there, the guy she meets at the pool party, and she's thinking about him the whole time.
Yeah, and great music, a great soundtrack, and probably what people were listening to in early 50s Texas.
And considering this is such a small, dusty town, and getting back to sex again here, Sonny is regular at hitting the jackpot with sex and property. He gets Ruth. He at least marries JC. He doesn't get anywhere with her, but he thinks he's going to. He inherits a pool hall from this father figure, Sam. And he doesn't really show any real aspirations to be much of anything in school or in sports or anything else. He ends up working as a roughneck himself later on when we see Dwayne come back and he's become a doughboy, if that's what you call him still in the 50s. And now it's Sonny who's working in the oil field.
There's no one left to compete with him for these prizes of women and property.
And the other thing I want to get back into is sex one more time as we jump around a little bit here. Much earlier in the film, JC's mother, who is Ellen Burstyn, did The Exorcist a couple years later. She won the Oscar the year after that for Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, the Scorsese film, Requiem for a Dream. Great career. She's been so good. She was recently in Interstellar in a small role. No one's going to recognize her probably in that at the end of the movie. But she encourages safe sex in West Texas in 1951. That's progressive and a little surprising.
Yeah, but smart. And again, a town with two deaths, lots of sex, and zero pregnancies.
Other key cast member of the older generation, Eileen Brennan. She was in The Sting a couple years later, Murder by Death, and she worked with Bogdanovich a few more times. The last thing I want to say about the cast is that the Ritters, John, who we all know from Three's Company, and Tex, his father, were in line to play Sonny and Sam.
That's right.
And had they gotten the roles, then you've got literally a father and son playing a father and son figure, but not really literally.
Instead, you have two brothers playing figures.
Okay, we talked a lot about Bogdanovich, so we can move on to McMurtry, who also wrote HUD, Terms of Endearment, Brokeback Mountain, and many other things. But those three great titles. Terms of Endearment won all kinds of Oscars, Brokeback won all kinds of Oscars, HUD won, I think, a couple at least. Of those three movies, HUD's probably my favorite, but several of those, including this one, Last Picture Show, HUD, Brokeback, Western themes, but also Lost Love, and spoiler alert on all these films, not very happy endings, including Terms of Endearment, actually, which has no Western themes whatsoever. The producer was Stephen Friedman, and of course the Schneiders, Harold and Bert and Bob Rafelson. They helped make the movie through BBS Productions. This is Friedman's first movie, another first-timer.
Yeah.
He later went on to do Slapshot, All of Me, and The Big Easy. I want to say a little bit more about Bogdanovich, because after this, he did What's Up, Doc?, Paper Moon. There's other films in the 70s, like Daisy Miller and some other ones. He did with Sybil Shepherd. Could have had a great career, much like William Friedkin, who we cover next week on The French Connection. And the two of them, along with Francis Ford Coppola, were part of the director's company. This is one of those stories that's in the book I've mentioned so often lately, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls. The director's company was founded by Charlie Bluthorn, who ran Paramount Pictures. And he wanted to have certain people in-house he could rely on to make prestigious movies. Coppola lasted for a long time. Now, of course, he flamed out in the 80s. And still makes movies even now, as does Friedkin occasionally, and sometimes even Bogdanovich. But at the time, Bogdanovich was the artist. Now, what did you think of his direction in this film? Again, an example, kind of like in Patton, where he isn't the first thing he noticed. With Hitchcock, he noticed the direction. With Kubrick, he really noticed the direction. With Scorsese, you do too.
I disagree with the notion that just because there isn't showy cinematography or big performances that you don't notice the direction. I think his subtlety and... I already compared him to Robert Altman, that meandering, seemingly directionless, but actually quite well-drawn storytelling. I think that is the mark of a really good director. He clearly is great with actors, which is a skill that you can't underestimate. I think his direction comes through. Oh my god, he decided to shoot the film in black and white. A decision he made based on the advice he got from Orson Welles.
Who said, of course you're going to shoot it in black
and white. Yeah, because he's trying to evoke those old John Ford movies. He wants it to look like The Grapes of Wrath, and he wants to... make people feel like they're watching a film from the 50s.
And the very next year he did What's Up, Doc?, which was a Howard Hawks-esque kind of film, and it's a remake of Bringing Up Baby, which of course is a Hawks film that made the AFI list, the only one that did, in fact. All right, the behind-the-scenes people, the cinematographer Robert Surtees, we've covered him three times now, and what a different group of films he's done, plus one that didn't make the list. Ben-Hur, The Graduate, now The Last Picture Show, he also did The Sting. And he's the one that shot this 185:1 black and white movie. This is the last black and white film we do until Raging Bull, 20 AFI years away. We also saw the director's cut DVD, so there are the added scenes. I actually don't know what they are. I've only ever owned that DVD. I never saw the previous version. When we do Lord of the Rings, the brand of the project, that's the version I know to be the director's cuts. I only saw the theatrical cuts once. I've seen the director's cuts every time since, so I can't really place what wasn't in the movie originally.
Well, I can tell you what was in this movie that was added. Apparently, they cut it for time because a studio refused to release any film that was over 119 minutes, so they had to cut something for time. The scenes that they cut out were the sex scene in the pool hall between JC and Abilene, which I think the film would totally miss.
Yeah.
There was so much subtlety in it.
A guy who knows what he's doing.
Yeah, taking advantage.
And yet,
and not even hiding the fact that he's taking advantage of her. He knows that she's only with him because she wants attention. And she wants to feel sexier than her mother.
And she doesn't enjoy that either, really.
And she doesn't enjoy it, yeah. And then the scene in the diner where Sonny and Dwayne decide to take that trip to Mexico. Originally, it just started with them in the truck telling Sam that they were going to Mexico. You don't see them come to the decision to do that with Genevieve watching over them. That's okay. In the director's cut. There's a few other scenes that were extended as well, but those were the two scenes that had been taken out altogether previously. Okay.
Well, speaking of taking things out, Don Cameron, who is the credited editor, he had done Easy Rider, and then the uncredited Bogdanovich, who did most of it, apparently. I don't really know what the story is about that. Let's move on. And the other technical person we got to mention, we said her already, Polly Platt, the production designer, didn't have a ton of production design to do because the movie was shot on location. But anytime you do something on location, you got to make that stuff work for your movie, though. You got to make it period, for one thing,
yeah,
20 years
film.
Before.
Yeah.
And she was such a huge part of his brain trust. So I don't know what was more vital, what she did on set or what she did with him and for him.
I just can't believe she was on set and he still carried on with Cybill Shepherd. Who was how old?
Something like 20.
Yeah. I mean, he was a young man, too. He was only 31, I think, when he was making this film.
Very young for a director who at that point was being acclaimed.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't even his first or second feature, was it?
He made Targets and he made some other
low-budget
film.
You know, for a director in New Hollywood, Bogdanovich has a tremendous amount of respect for old Hollywood.
Oh, yeah. If you ever got a chance to sit him down in your living room, even now, and just let him tell you stories about those directors, you could probably spend the whole night just listening to these stories, even if you heard them before, and they'd be thrilling to hear all over again. He does a great Hitchcock impersonation, too. All right, the influence of the film. So there's a sequel, Texasville. Bridges, Timothy Bottoms, Shepard, Leachman, Brennan, and Quaid are all in that sequel. I saw it. I don't remember it all that well. It wasn't a very successful film, and by that point, Bogdanovich was in the wasteland. He did do Mask. I didn't mention that in his credits. That was the mid-80s.
Wow.
And that was a pretty solid film. People liked that one.
Popular.
People still remember that film. I think maybe his own ego has really harmed him. He's one of those guys that you wonder why he didn't have a career that was better than it was. But it's almost like people wanted to stomp him down when he had a chance to be stomped.
Yeah, he had
and
a pretty
keep
bad reputation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The movie was influenced by John Ford. We've said that so often. But I think specifically, How Green Is My Valley.
Yeah, I can see that.
And I'm not a huge fan of that film, but it is a solid movie by
Ford.
It's
a great-looking film, at the very least. There's definitely visual components.
And one thing about How Green Is My Valley that works so well are the moments that aren't dialogue. There's that great moment. We talked about it many months ago in some other production, probably one of the John Ford movies, where he resists going to a close-up of a character who's watching two other characters get married, and he's in love with the woman.
Mm-hmm.
And why didn't he show that close-up? Because they'd just use it. Because back then, directors didn't have the same kind of power they were starting to get in the 70s. And that's a great example of restraint. You see the character in the background, and that's enough.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely Bogdanovich has the same sort of tone and attitude in this one. There's a Stephen King novel called Lysis or Lysis Story. I've never even heard of this book until I read about this on Wikipedia. And it often refers to this movie, and a character even watches this film. And the last influence I want to mention is that it cast the young newcomers and launched so many careers like American Graffiti did only a few years later.
Well, speaking of American Graffiti is a day in the life. This film's a year in the life, but they have so many similarities. To me, it's like a lighthearted version of The Last Picture Show. It certainly would be like George Lucas to take something edgy and just kind of make a clean, fun Hollywood version of it. It's more entertaining, at the least. And certainly a more well-loved film now, decades later.
All right, the awards and other AFI list is one of the shortest we've ever done. A lot of Oscar nominations and wins. It won for Leachman and for Ben Johnson, supporting actress and supporting actor. And then it had six other nominations. Best Picture, Best Director for Bogdanovich, supporting actor for Bridges, supporting actress for Ellen Burstyn, the script and the cinematography by Surtees. made the National Film Registry in 1998, and the only AFI nomination apart from the two main lists. It was nominated for the top 100 genres in the Western category.
Western?
Yeah, debatably even that.
Yeah, really.
But nothing else. No quotes, no songs, no passions, none of that stuff. Passions may have been a very suitable choice for this.
Yes. Now that you mention the Oscars, I'm reminded of one more potential influenced film, and that was a film that got nominated for Best Picture last year. Another black and white film, Nebraska. I don't think that they have similar plots, but thematically and visually, there's definitely lots of connections.
Yeah, and a very solid film, too. We like that one a lot.
But another cute, funny film that's actually about very sad themes and about death.
And it's on Netflix, so if you haven't seen it, check it out.
Oh, yeah.
Recommend it highly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's it for Last Picture Show. What are your parting thoughts?
I think we're going to have to agree to disagree on this one. I think it belongs on the list.
So you put it on there. Huh?
Yeah, I'm satisfied with it being 95th. I think people should watch it. I really do.
Okay, I think people should watch it. We own it. I like the movie. It's a very fine film. I'm very glad it's in the 400 nominees. If all the 400 films were ranked, I'd be very happy if it was in the top 150. I don't think it belongs on the list. It doesn't influence very much, really. Nothing all that significant. Not blatantly and obviously, like Wizard of Oz or Star Wars has. Didn't make a ton of money. People don't really think about it now. I don't expect this podcast to be one of our bigger downloads of all time. And it didn't make a lot of other AFI lists. It didn't make any other AFI list.
Well, if I was in charge and I got to decide which films people thought were important and popular, then it would definitely be on my top 100 list.
All right. That's it then. So, everybody, have an excellent Christmas. Holiday season or not, we will have a podcast next week to close out the year. It'll be the film that beat out Last Picture Show for the top prizes at the Oscars. It's Billy Friedkin's obsessed cop action thriller, The French Connection. You have or have not seen that?
I have not. I'm really looking forward to it.
And that one is pretty influential.
Mm-hmm.
All right, the coming attractions trivia for The French Connection. Popeye Doyle is one of eight law enforcers on the heroes and villains list. How many of those eight are on the hero side of that list, and who are they?
Ooh, that's a great question. All right, so for the answer to that, please tune into next week's podcast. You can also find more trivia from Ryan and me and lots of other fun stuff, including links to some of the things that we talked about in today's podcast, on our website. So please visit top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. What do you think of The Last Picture Show? We would love to hear what you think. Please send us a message. Our email address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsors, Sparkplug Coffee.
Oh, quit prissing. I don't think you done it right anyway.
And cut.